Hello and welcome to Charity Pulse, your regular update on news and happenings in the charity sector, the podcast where purpose meets personality. I'm James Saunders, a partner at Morkings & Smith. I'm joined as ever by my co-hosts, Catherine Rastromji, partner and head of charities at Shakespeare Martineau, and Charles Mesquita, charities director at Quilter Cheviot. And we're going to dive into the heart of the charity sector, unpack the big issues, spotlight unsung heroes, and share the stories that matter. You may be listening to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, any of our respective organisations' websites. However you're listening, you're very welcome, but please don't forget to like and follow and subscribe and generally hit any positive feedback buttons you can. Back to business at hand then. Charity Commission, several new regulatory investigations and cases have emerged this last week. The Charity Commission's opened statutory inquiries into charities over issues, including, yet again, unauthorised trustee payments and unmanaged conflicts of interest, which we'll return to in a bit. Separately, charities are under scrutiny for spending concerns and other wider governance issues, and more of these cases are arising. So Charity Commission continues to be active and busy with its investigations. But back to that first order of business for the week and that politics to an extent, and the King's Speech and new government policy was announced this last week. Not much of a reaction, I would say, from the sector and the charity sector, particularly the representative bodies. Responses seem to be generally made by individual charities rather than any of the representative bodies. There's still serious concerns over lack of concrete action on social care funding in particular, battling the cost of living crisis, albeit, of course, the results, the economic results, the GDP results and numbers this last week have been reasonably positive, which might possibly give the government a little bit of breathing space before the impact of the Iran war really hits in the next set of results. In our sector, the National Care Forum seemed to sum it up really with generally a commentary that there's slim pickings, in their case particularly for adult social care, but that seemed to be the theme across a lot of organisations across education, health, social welfare, environmental sectors all seem to be not really much for us here. Charles, Catherine, your thoughts on this? Charles, I'll come to you first. Anything that really you saw from the King's Speech or from the government policy being announced, or was it all a bit of a damp squib, Charles?
Well, I have to say, I got quite excited when you suggested we might talk about it. But then I was thinking about the King's Speech in the US, where I think he played an absolute, His Royal Highness played a blinder in both in Congress and at the state dinner. I mean, the government is, I think, somewhere between a rock and a hard place, particularly with what's going on in the Middle East, and that we're going to just have increased problem in the cost of living crisis. To be honest with you, I think the damage has already been done with the increase in national insurance contributions, and I think the sector's still reeling from that. The only other issue, which is probably something is more of a, on a personal basis, is the highlighting of food security, which I do think is a massive issue, and there are some fundamental things the government needs to address. So, yes, probably the current government should focus less on leadership change and getting on and doing the job that they were elected to do on the mandate they were set.
Yeah. Catherine?
It's interesting, isn't it? I picked up more so the lack of commentary from the umbrella bodies. And I just see that as a slightly missed opportunity. I think if we're trying to say that charities are crucial and fundamental to the operation of UK society, then we should be hammering that home at every opportunity. And I think the King's Speech could have been a useful platform to say, you know, once again, charities don't really seem to be factored into plans, and we've still got these challenges, and don't forget about us and the issues that we're dealing with on a daily basis. I think it's that to the general public that we need to keep drip and get that message across. But I would see that more so for the umbrella bodies to have some sort of sustained campaign, because I think in contrast to, for instance, Hospice UK, I think they're doing a fantastic job at keeping on in terms of what hospices do and the challenges they face. It's not just kind of flash in the pan. So I did think possibly there was a missed opportunity for this one.
Quick shout out to a group that I know quite well, the Society of London Theatre, one of the representative bodies of charity groups and or commercial groups in general. I mean, the one that will affect some theatre charities in my case. They were saying how good the European Partnership Bill might be, and also the inclusion of a draft ticketing bill, which hopefully will address ticket touts. So there was a few bits in there for some of our subsectors. Moving on, so the second point this week, second item, the Charity Commission has updated. This is about a couple of weeks ago, actually. The Charity Commission updated CC 29, as
Tonight.
Charles might call it, Charity CC 29, Conflicts of Interest Guidance. I mean, to me, this reflects there's been so many reported stories recently, many of which we've covered over time around this topic. And I mentioned earlier, even this week, new Charity Commission investigations over unauthorised trustee payments and conflicts of interest, or badly managed conflicts of interest. There was a case this week related to. So I think we mentioned the William Blake House problem matter before, which the Charity Commission was investigating. As part of that investigation, they have now had a look at a couple of other charities, linked charities, and started investigating them again over failures of conflicts of interest. So, did this prompt anything, Catherine? I'll come to you first on this one. Did this pr prompt anything in your mind around particularly these charities with conflicts of interest issues?
Yeah, I mean, I found it fascinating because the article said casework suggested that most unmanaged conflicts of interest came from a lack of awareness rather than deliberate wrongdoing, the commission said. But I just find that staggering. I mean, I do trustee training year in, year out, two or three times a year, public awareness sessions that trustees regularly come to. They take their responsibilities very, very seriously. Conflicts is a particular area where they are looking at conflicts of interest, conflicts of duty, conflicts of loyalty. They are very careful about making sure that's all managed. So to hear that it's a lack of awareness, I thought, I'm not sure it is. I think that's possibly more so people are saying, oh, we didn't realise. But I think there is this distortion where people are looking to charities as an income stream to fund something they want to do, rather than understanding that discipline and rigor that as a trustee, you are an unpaid volunteer. So I was slightly surprised at that. And then I was fascinated by the William Blake House story, the fact that the Charity Commission are essentially tracking the trustees. So they're saying, well, you're a trustee of these other charities, so now we're going to have a look at them as well. So they've come into the frame, whereas actually they weren't under the spotlight at all. And I thought that's really interesting that.
And potentially finding fault in those other ones as well. I mean, you can't help feeling that it's almost infectious, isn't it? Where it, or rather, if there's problems in one organisation, then the same problems will occur in related or where there are related trustees.
Yeah, which
Charles?
makes you think, doesn't it, that you've got to be careful about who's on your board and what other interests they have as well.
Charles?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, conflicts are inevitable, and I'm a bit like Catherine. I think they are. I think most people are very diligent. In fact, sometimes I think people are too diligent, and get really scared by it. I mean, I've had occasions where I've sat in a board, and we've had investments in particular companies, and people said, "Oh, we got personal investments in that." And you go, "Well, yeah, but hold a second here. You own 0.00001 of the company, and we're owning 0.1." So actually, that really isn't a conflict. So it to my mind, it's all around, what is the personal benefit into that, and just being very clear. And also, I think from trustees is to have a clear process. You can discuss things openly, and then if you're going to make a decision, that person who's conflicted, get them to leave the room, so that you can have that thing. And the other thing I always go back to is if this hit the press, the Daily Mail or the Mirror or whoever it may be, how is that optic likely to play out in the public? How easy it is for you to come back with a robust defense. I think defense is too defensive a word. I think a robust response that actually proves that you've gone through the process and you're doing the right thing for the organization.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, obviously an ongoing issue, and one that doesn't seem to be have any enormously effective solution at the moment. The next one, the next topic to cover, this is really good actually, Charity Excellence Framework, which is Ian McClintock. Have you either of you met him? He's got
No.
this website, the Charity Excellence Framework. It's really, really good, really useful for a lot of charities. And it's he, he's they've produced a report, Small Charity Crisis, Vital and Under Threat, well worth a look. But it taps into what we've talked about before, which is at the moment small charities, and this actually relates to what we were just talking about, but small charities really struggling for support in the absence of the small charities set representative bodies, the Small Charities Coalition, which, as we've said, it doesn't exist anymore, and others have represented the smaller sector, and how much they are at risk, and the sort of support that they need. Again, Catherine, I'll come to you first on this. Did anything in here particularly pique your interest?
It is very interesting, and I have seen Ian's post, I suppose, on LinkedIn as well around AI, because he's very prominent in terms of how the difference AI could make to smaller charities would be phenomenal. And I think he did post a little tongue-in-cheek comment that he was at a conference, and there were some of the largest charities in the country saying they weren't taking advantage of AI because they didn't have the budget for it, which was a bit of a kind of sniggering. You've got more budget than anybody else has got budget to do this. So really interesting findings. I thought, yeah, and a great resource, I suppose, for people to be aware of if they're not already. But I suppose where I did slightly lean back rather than in was we're back in this perma crisis again. Everything's a crisis. And I just thought, in some ways, I'd want to turn it on its head and say, this is an untapped potential. Here's the opportunity. Here's some top tips. Here's how to, get on top of this and make the most of what's available to you as an education piece rather than a. I just think we can talk ourselves down too much, and then the mood tends to dip and the energy levels dip, and maybe charities just think, oh, it's too difficult and everybody else is finding it difficult, therefore let's not try. And I don't think that's quite right.
Yeah,
Yeah,
Charles.
I agree. I completely agree with Catherine. Words from Deborah Alcock-Tyler, Chief Executive of the Directorate of Social Change, will always turn round to you because particularly a lot of these small charities are getting funding from local authorities where budgets are being squeezed and cut and everything else. And she'll say there's always money there. It's just about how you go and ask for it. I just think I agree with Catherine. I think we can get in too much of a downwards negative cycle. Life is challenging without a doubt, and it's likely to get even more so. But saying that, where there's a will, there's a way.
Good. I again, I'd recommend that everyone have a good look at the website and see what's on there, because it's very useful stuff, especially for those smaller charities that are lacking support. There is some there. Turning to an article in Charity Finance actually this last week, and they had a feature on public sector commissioning. So returning back to where we kind of started this episode around, the relationship with government. There's some commentary involving, including some contributions from the NCVO's CFO about charities commissioning from government, and the headline, too lengthy, bureaucratic and onerous, but quite a long feature on this. And again, we've talked about this at length in the past. Charles, I'll come to you first, because this is obviously, something that you've talked about with some vigor in the past. The appetite for public sector contracts is falling. Would you agree with that? It's changing. I know that I've got a few clients who have been handing back contracts that they simply can't make work. To the advantage of their organisation, but to the detriment of their beneficiaries, it could be argued. How do you feel about this, Charles?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, we've talked about this at length, haven't we? And I think there is no doubt about it. The problem, of course, charities always face is that the passion that they have for their beneficiaries, that they don't want their beneficiaries to be disadvantaged, and therefore they do everything they possibly can, including dipping into their own funds, rather than pushing back and saying to the local authorities, "Well, okay, fine. If you don't want to provide that service, you explain that to your constituents." And I don't think, again, the sector, which is easy to say, and I agree, difficult to do. I mean, Catherine mentioned the hospices earlier. You know, there's always a tug of war about how much money the NHS pays to hospices and why there should be so much regional variation between one hospice and another, and children's hospices to adult hospices. It makes no sense whatsoever. But I think the really big thing, and you know, I had quite a lot of hope that Keir Starmer and the Labour government coming in was actually going to have a look at this and really make some changes to it, because the cost that charities have to go through, the frequency of a pitching, I think is completely unforgivable. And I think there just needs to be a complete change in the way they do that. And then the final thing I would just say is that we also, the sector needs to put its own house in order, because I think grant makers are also doing something similar in making it very bureaucratic for relatively small sums of money, where really what we should be doing is, you know, if we've been set up as a grant maker to help support, we should be going out and finding and then really supporting and not putting this through this whole process. And I think that this culture of having to check everything and being suspicious that things aren't being spent correctly just puts an additional burden and on organizations that really can't afford it.
Good, Catherine.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I mean, I would agree with both of you. I saw it more as kind of market forces that charities are saying, we're not playing this game anymore. We don't want to bid for it. We're not going to. And you've got to let that ripple through and have some consequence. Because there was one paragraph in one of the articles that honestly made me sick to my stomach, that it was a chief exec of a charity saying she recalls a big contract her organisation felt best placed to deliver, but did not have the in-house expertise, capacity and resources to bid for. So they paid £35,000 to an external organisation to support the charity in writing the bid. £35,000. I mean, and then I'm thinking, well, whatever you're making on that contract, you now need to make 35,000 plus, and that just can't be right. I mean, I just thought that was the world's gone mad.
Charles?
Yeah, the other thing I would just also say is that from an employment point of view, it also makes it really, really difficult for charities to know how to staff themselves. If a contract's coming up every 2 or 3 years, that's leading to having, you know, shorter and shorter contracts for staff, which is also you're losing a wealth of knowledge, experience, and everything else, and getting this massive turnover. So it's just creating more and more problems. I think government really does have a responsibility to look at this and to look at it in the round, not just at this sort of getting best value or whatever's the cheapest. I mean, they had a big enough problem with the post office, which has ended up costing the taxpayers a lot of money. This is something that they really could address, and they could have a much better, I think, and more productive relationship with the sector.
Good. Couple more, well, slightly off. Let's say they're slightly off tack stories. I saw the homeless. My friends at Homeless Link promoted 1 million acts to hope this week, which is the week-long campaign, 13th, the 20th of May, happening at the moment, which is great, and it's supported by, you know, all sorts of brilliant charities, YMCA. Save the Children, Trussell, you know, Friends of the Earth, the major one, large ones, small ones, but that's going on at the moment. So a bit of a shout out to that, which support that if you can. I would be remiss not to say in my world that there's an awful lot of attention on the charity SORP for accounting regulations at the moment. We've got a lot of seminars going on. I'd encourage anyone with any sort of financial interest in charities finance to attend ours and any number of webinars and seminars that must be going on right now. Our next one is on revenue recognition, 30th of June. Sign up is open, so please do sign up and get yourself registered on that. And our webinars on a lot of these things are on our website at the moment. But it's a big deal in the charity finance world at the moment, with, you know, the new thresholds coming in, the new SORP coming in for this later this year. The 31st December year ends are going to be subject to it. So quite a lot of change going on.
James, are you finding that a lot of people are struggling with the I mean, it's because there are two or three, isn't it, major changes?
Yeah, I think it's still going through a bit of discovery, really. It's really interesting, these webinars that we're running. I think people have got the basics of what the issues are, but there's so many nuances coming out of the questions from seminar attendees at the moment. We're in a particular situation. What about this? What about that? And that is what's really interesting, is the nuances. Unfortunately, there's very little black and white in some of these areas. There's an awful lot of there's large amounts of shades of grey, in where the questions lead us to. So at the moment, a lot of what we're doing is taking the questions we get and finding out the answers, rather than necessarily just stating what the SORB itself says. It's not that simple.
But isn't that always the way whenever we get a change like this, is that you?
I think we're more aware of it this time. I don't remember it being quite so nuanced last time round. I think there's an awful lot of ingrained knowledge in the charity sector, in the finance teams, in organisations. They've spent the last 10 years actually looking in a bit more depth at the SORP than they would have done in previous incarnations, and now they're ready with more questions at an earlier stage. That's what it feels like to me. I think in the last iteration, 2015 was the last update. I think people left it to be told what was, relevant to them. I think this time there's a lot more questioning at a lot earlier stage, well in advance of when people are actually having to prepare their own accounts. So that, which is encouraging, really. It does show there's more inquisitiveness, there's more understanding of the regulations and how important this sort of thing is to financial statements.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. That is probably all we've got time for this week. There's an awful lot of ground covered there. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Charles. Thank you to the listener for tuning in to this episode of Charity Pulse. We hope the conversations offered some insights and some inspiration and some element of understanding of some aspects of what we're doing in the charity and social impact worlds at the moment. If you've got any questions or topics you'd like us to cover in future episodes, please do let us know. Whether you're a charity professional, passionate volunteer, someone who cares about making a difference, we do try and aim to make sure there's something here for you. Don't forget, please, to follow, leave a review, share our podcast with your network, and do join us next time as we continue to explore the challenges and opportunities facing our sector. Thanks very much. Bye bye for now.